Want to advertise your business in a cost-effective way? It's time to give podcast advertising a try. Research shows a high rate of podcast listeners made a purchase as a result of an ad they heard on a podcast. Visit podbean.com/brands to launch a cost-effective podcast advertising campaign in minutes. That's podbean.com/brands.
Welcome to Yolitics, the home of cold beer and hot takes on Texas politics.
Howdy, folks. Welcome back to another episode of Yolitics. I hope it's not too echoey in here. I'm in the kitchen. I'm pulling a wheeler.
Eating while on a Zoom.
Yeah, I'm slamming some chips because I'm starving, and if I feel like pound a beer here, then I'm going to be talking some crazy stuff on this podcast.
yeah, it'll hit your stomach with nothing in there. That's never a good outcome.
Right.
And you know what? You're totally forgiven. I don't know how many bowls of cereal I have consumed here in front of you, and I know it's not a pretty eating exercise either, because usually, I just stand over the sink and eat, and so I just kind of shovel it in, and
over the sink? Why? Are you, like, dropping stuff everywhere like
falls.
A wild animal?
It falls.
See, our listener doesn't realize that, you know, we can see each other on the Zoom calls here, and Wheeler is always pounding a bowl of cereal. What's your favorite cereal? What do you like? Lucky Charms?
Frosted Mini Wheats? No, I don't like a lot of sugar in it, and so I'll go. This is
grape
the most
nuts?
Boring ever. No, I used to do Grape Nuts a lot. Most boring ever. I have basically the knockoff store version of Cheerios. I think it's called Toasted Oats. They don't have any sugar or barely any sugar in
but,
them.
But Cheerios is pretty cheap as is. Why are you going for the knockoff version of Cheerios? I mean, it's not a fancy cereal.
I don't know. I guess I'm cheap. I don't know. And then sometimes I get really wild and do Bran Flakes.
Oh, risque,
yeah.
Huh? Scandalous.
Yeah. Those are on the crazy days. But yeah, you eat it over the sink. You don't do that?
Dude, I don't know anybody that does that.
I can't tell you how many times I have eaten. This is because I'm always so rushed, okay? So I'll do lunch this way too, or dinner sometimes if I'm in a huge rush.
You'll eat dinner over the sink?
Yes, I will eat dinner over the sink. And sometimes, like with my hand, like I have stuff in my hands and I'm just like cramming it in my mouth so I can hurry up and get done. And whatever falls, it falls in the sink. It's no big deal. You don't have to clean up. You just, move
You're
on.
You're a pig, man. What the hell are you doing?
It's what life has done to me. I am that rushed. So hopefully hopefully our boss is listening as usual and look at what has become of me, because I'm always working so hard.
Exactly.
That's all I can say.
What are you drinking? Paycheck.
What are you drinking today,
by the way? I'm excited about this, man. I'm excited about this episode, but I'm excited about this beer too. This is called the Texas Troubadour.
Oh, I like that.
It's a Pilsner.
Okay.
It's from Wild Acre Brewing Company over in Fort Worth. And it says, living loud and play hard for the Troubadour, 5.7% alcohol per volume, 13th floor music. I'm not sure what the rest of it is. I'm sure we'll have a listener tell us that I'm missing the bigger picture on this thing. But let's try it out here. Let's see what this Pilsner's like.
I'm going to have to try that because I like Pilsners, and I like the word Troubadour, to be honest.
That's
How
easy.
Is it?
Yeah, that's an easy beer. I like that one.
I like
that's
that.
Good. Texas
I'm excited about what I'm having today, too, because I've returned to Texas beers now after last week. And this is the last in a series of the fridge cleanout beers. It was in the back of the fridge. And yes, you read it right. I just held it up to the camera there. This is the it's an IPA. That's why it sat in the back of the fridge, because
it's a low calorie.
Gosh, you're quick. I barely held it up there. It is.
Dude.
Just
make an effort for this podcast. I mean,
This is why it sat in the back of the fridge. I'm still doing the fridge clean out. It's ending today. And whatever, some elf that puts these things in my fridge put in a low-calorie, hop skinny, they call it, low-calorie IPA. It is 95 calories and only 4 carbs. It's made in Dallas at Community Beer Company.
Well,
this is what I'm having. I'm not, I haven't been looking forward to it, but, it may surprise, because my bar is low for IPAs in general.
And don't drink it. You're not doing this podcast over the sink, are you?
I'm not.
Okay.
Because eating.
We'll have to get Mrs. Wheeler a beer list when she makes her next store run.
Or I'm just going to have to go do it myself. That's what I need to do, so I can pick out a Troubadour this time.
Right.
Okay, so we are close. You know, I think we're still in early voting now. We're getting close to this very off year election. There are some, different proposals on the ballot for, you know, the Texas Constitution. There's some very local races on there. And Jason, you know, it's always kind of sad. Like, I always try to show up on these years, especially because it's kind of sad when you see the vote totals in a year like this. It's so bad. It's so low. So many of our decisions on how we spend a lot of money, like for schools and so forth. Yeah. So many decisions on constitutional changes. They're made in these years by a very relative few Texans.
And our listener is saying, what are you talking about? Early voting. Is there an election coming up? Yes, there is an election. It's a week from today as we do this here. It's going to be on November the 2nd. Mm-hmm. Early voting is underway. It's a statewide election. These are the constitutional amendments. There are 8 of them out there. You can run through them. You know, some of these are hot button issues. A couple of them are hot button issues. I think the most controversial maybe is the one that voters can say yes or no to. And that is allowing people to go to church all the time, regardless of whether there's an emergency, like in the pandemic. This, of course, is born out of the pandemic when people were not able to gather. Some counties, I believe Dallas County is one of them, said that you can't go to church either because that might be a breeding ground for the virus. Now, the legislature has made that or wants to make it state law with a constitutional amendment if voters pass it next Tuesday.
And chances are that those handful of voters who will show up are going to be spending a lot of your money on these bond issues with school districts or picking your local leaders. So, you know, try to get out there and vote if you can. Now, we will expect, though, that turnout is going to be much higher for next year's midterm elections. Mm-hmm. There's a lot at stake there. And one of the things that drives it and that I think is going to drive it, especially next year, Jason, is that we have this docket in front of the Supreme Court of the United States this year where they are really, I mean, they're biting into some meaty issues here. A lot of these social issues that really divide this country. And I think that that is sort of the X factor going into next year's midterms, that you're going to have a lot of people on the left and on the right very energized by what's happening with the Supreme Court with some of these big cases that they've decided to take on. Not the least of which, of course, is SB 8 here in Texas, the new abortion law.
And you know, November 2nd is the election we were talking about. November 1st is when the U.S. Supreme Court said it would hear arguments on the abortion law, the Texas abortion law, which was passed by the legislature, signed into law by Governor Abbott, and then immediately challenged by a few people in court. And the law, to refresh your memory, if you don't remember this, the law bans abortions after 6 weeks once a fetal heartbeat is detected, which is about 6 weeks or so. And, you know, the progressives, Democrats, liberals are saying this is clearly square in the face of Roe versus Wade, the mm-hmm. landmark abortion law. So that's coming up. And if you remember the headlines a few days ago, last Friday, the Supreme Court said that it would not grant a request. Again, they were asked, it would not grant a request to immediately block the ban. Instead, it's going to take up the oral arguments on the first. And I'm excited about today's guest because, you know, the word legalese,
I do.
We use it all the time. And legalese is kind of just that little phrase that, you know, something's hard to understand and difficult to parse through. And I apply it to so much, especially with legal jargon and trying to figure out exactly what the merits of a case are and what specifically is being argued. Our guest today is great at cutting through this stuff, man.
Yeah, his name is Steve Vladek. We've had him here on the program before. Anytime that we're trying to understand complex things that have to do especially with the Constitution or the Supreme Court, we turn to him. He is a law professor at the University of Texas at Austin. He is a crazy busy guy, so we're happy anytime we can get him on the line. And here we have him today. Steve, thank you so much for doing this with us. Let's dive right in. We got a lot to talk about.
Let's start with this. How significant do you think this Supreme Court term is going to be? And what specifically are you really watching?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be a really important term, Jason, one way or the other, because it's going to tell us a lot about whether the new middle of the court, So Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, you know, I think to some extent Neil Gorsuch, whether they're going to be in any way sort of swayed by the institutional concerns that are increasingly being raised by especially folks on the left, or whether, you know, this is the term to take the new conservative majority for a spin on, you know, gun rights, on abortion, on affirmative action. And, you know, those are two very different stories depending upon where we are this time in June.
And it certainly is teed up, though, this time, Steve, because we've seen in years past where they've decided to take cases and hear cases that really don't seem like they touch as many nerves. This time around, it's like they went for everything. They just loaded up the grocery cart.
I think that's right. And I think part of that is a reaction to the lawyers. I mean, I think, you know, once Justice Kennedy retired in 2018, and then when Justice Ginsburg died in 2020, I think a lot of folks saw opportunities where the, you know, this was a chance to take advantage of the new court. And so, you know, the court can't go out and find these cases, but the lawyers can certainly help bring them to the court. And so, you know, I think as opposed to last term, where some of it was just sort of the lag from the succession of Justice Barrett for Justice Ginsburg, you know, this is the new court a full year in with time enough for these cases to have percolated their way up.
Well, so let's break down some of these issues here. Abortion is one of the big ones we're talking about here in Texas. Yeah. The case in Mississippi is a little different, and that one has precedence over the one here. Is that one ahead of the Texas case?
So, you know, as we sit here recording, yes, the Mississippi case is set for argument, I think, the first week of December. That is a case about a 15-week ban where basically Mississippi has prohibited just about all abortions after the 15th week of pregnancy. There was always a way for the court to uphold the Mississippi ban without totally getting rid of a constitutional right to abortion, just by moving the line from viability to 15 weeks. That would still be an enormous shift, but it would leave intact at least a meaningful period where pregnant folks could still have a constitutional right to an abortion. The Texas case is the direct assault, right? Because the Texas case, there's no universe in which Texas's six-week ban and Roe and Casey can coexist. I think the question as we're sitting here recording is the court actually going to leapfrog over the Federal Court of Appeals, the Fifth Circuit, and get the Texas case up to the court to be argued alongside the Mississippi case, which is what the federal government is asking it to do. It's what the providers are asking it to do. And in that case, you know, this now becomes just an enormous referendum on not just the future of abortion, Jason, but also on the procedural maneuvers, right, that Texas pulled in the Texas case.
Well, let's talk about those procedural maneuvers just for a moment here, too, because that's kind of what's made so much news on this. I presume the maneuvers you're talking about are the public enforcement. Is that right?
So public enforcement, but Jason, not just public enforcement, at the expense of state enforcement, where, you know, the lawyers have now said in their papers that the point was to make it harder to challenge the 6 week ban. And, you know, I think what concerns me is, like, listen, folks have strong views about abortion and no one's going to be persuaded to change their mind by anyone like me. The problem is that the Texas law on the procedural side is not abortion specific. And so whatever we think about the right to an abortion, whether it should even be a right to an abortion, you know, I'm troubled by a precedent where any state legislature can frustrate the enforcement of any constitutional right, maybe one that we like more or, you know, or not, just by pulling the move Texas has pulled here. And so that's why I think, you know, the Supreme Court, if it does, as it has been asked to do, accelerate the Texas cases, argue them alongside the Mississippi case, I think might be thinking the same thing and might see it, guys, as an opportunity to at least look like they're compromising and look like they're splitting the difference, where they would strike down the Texas law but allow the Mississippi law to remain on the books. And then everyone's pissed off and the court can say, look, we're not partisan.
I wanted to ask you this, Steve. So this new Texas abortion law, it went into effect September 1st. It was challenged at the last minute at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court decided to go ahead and let it go forward. Justice Sotomayor was scathing. She said it was flagrantly unconstitutional. Then earlier this month, we had a federal judge who temporarily blocked that law in Texas, also saying that it was flagrantly unconstitutional. But that didn't last long. It got to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is very conservative, and they allowed the law to stay in effect here. I was interested because, you know, when that federal judge decided to block the law, this judge wrote a 113-page opinion that just laid out the case against this Texas abortion law. But then when it got to the Fifth Circuit, which reversed that decision, that was down to a paragraph. Is that significant? And does that matter now when this goes before the Supreme Court? Because the federal judge, it seems like, just gave such a roadmap. But then you saw the Fifth Circuit just giving this tiny paragraph.
Right. The federal the district judge went the whole way and the Fifth Circuit got off at exit one. I think it's significant. I mean, so it sounds worse than it is in practice. And what I mean by that is it is not unheard of in the mine run of cases where a district court issues a lengthy opinion and the Court of Appeals temporarily blocks that decision without getting too much into the details. Like, that of itself is not unheard of. I think the reason why it's especially revealing here is because the Fifth Circuit said more than nothing. there's like, I think, two sentences of analysis in the Fifth Circuit's order. And the Fifth Circuit said, we're staying Judge Pittman's injunction. We're allowing SBA to go back into effect for the same reasons that we, you know, didn't allow the providers to block SB8 back at the end of August. And that's problematic from my perspective, because actually the district court had spent a whole lot of time explaining why this case was different from those cases, why the fact that it's the federal government who's the plaintiff changes the analysis. And so, you know, I think it probably doesn't do Texas any favors in the Supreme Court that the Fifth Circuit's analysis was so cursory, not because in general that's a bad thing, but because in this context specifically, I think it wasn't an effective rebuttal of what the district court wrote.
I think I was curious there too, though. Does that federal judge's 113-page, it was just laid out all the way. Does that make it easier for the lawyers who are arguing for the U.S. government side on this? Can they sort of look at that and go, here's how we go about this?
Sure. And I think the key, guys, is, you know, Judge Pittman, it's not his first rodeo. I mean, right, he is a progressive district judge in the Fifth Circuit. So he knows his audience. And my sense of his opinion, which frankly, like, I would encourage folks who are listening to us, you know, to go read his opinion. Like, it's accessible. And I think his audience, guys, was not the Fifth Circuit. I think his audience was Brett Kavanaugh. And, you know, I think he knew that one way or the other, whether SB8 was going to be frozen or allowed to go into place was going to depend upon exactly the moment we're in right now, which is the federal government asking the Supreme Court to vacate the Fifth Circuit stay. It takes five votes to do that. It is clear from the court's earlier ruling in the providers case that there are at least four votes because of the four justices who dissented there. So Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Now the question is there a fifth vote? And I think there's no doubt that the reason why Judge Pittman wrote 113 pages was his attempt to find one.
And you said Kavanaugh, Brett Kavanaugh, the new Supreme Court justice, is he, could he be the new swing vote?
You know, if only because there aren't that many other options. You know, I think we've seen in a couple of other cases, although not in the abortion context, where he and Justice Barrett have been more likely to stay closer to Chief Justice Roberts than the Thomas Alito Gorsuch camp. If there's going to be a fifth vote, I have to think that it's going to be one or both of, right, Kavanaugh and Barrett.
And is this going to happen, do you think, with other controversial issues that are before the court right now, including a big guns case that'll happen in this term? Is that the way in that a lot of progressives are seeing, is through Kavanaugh?
You know, yes and no. I mean, I think in the sense that, like, if you don't have Kavanaugh, you're in deep trouble. But I mean, guys, the flip side is, right, that if we look at the court as sort of holistically, and we look at the whole term, you know, from a, like, if the court splits the difference in the abortion cases, I actually think that buys room, right, for the conservatives to flex their muscles in other cases. Right, you know, to get a really strong 6-3 ruling in the New York gun case, right, to potentially get a 6-3 ruling in the Harvard affirmative action case if it gets up in time. You know, it's weird to think of this as like horse trading, but there's a degree to which, you know, we look at the court's terms as singular entities. And a term in which the court, you know, preserves Roe and strikes down SB 8, even while tightening abortion access, is what that headline is going to pull a lot of weight, even if the rest of the high profile important cases break uniformly right down those ideological lines.
And Steve, this is the last question on abortion for me, but to make sure I'm clear, the Supreme Court is not considering anything to do with the enforcement of this, the public enforcement. It's all about the viability, right? The 15 weeks or the 6 weeks.
So it's a little tricky, Jason. The provider's case, as opposed to the federal government's case, raises challenges to the enforcement scheme. But they really are sort of secondary. And frankly, the Supreme Court, even if we assume that the court is going to take up both the provider's case and the federal government's case and argue them together with the Mississippi case, there are ways to duck that, right? The court could sort of, without blessing the enforcement scheme, Jason, the court could deprive it of efficacy in frustrating review. The court could say, even though the Texas has done this to try to frustrate review, here's how we are able to review it. And that would not be striking down the enforcement scheme. It would just be basically saying, yeah, you can do that, but that's not going to insulate the substantive law from challenge, which I think, you know, will take some of the sort of the teeth out of it, right? Yeah. The sort of the purpose out of it.
All right, so a lot to talk about there with the abortion law here in Texas, SB 8, and the challenge that the Supreme Court has now taken up, the challenge to that law. So there's still a lot more, though, that the court is going to be getting to, a lot of other controversial issues this time, Jason. We're going to dive into those here in just a second. First, though, we would like you, the listener, to take a quick listen to our sponsor.
We're back for Yolitics here. We have Stephen Vladek on the line with us, Whiteley and Wheeler here, talking about the Supreme Court and what all is going on. The term has just started, the new term for the Supreme Court, and as it is considering a number of things, we spent the last 15, 20 minutes or so discussing abortion. But that's not all, Jason.
Steve, let's go to that gun case that you were talking about that comes out of New York. This one might sound a little strange when people in Texas hear about this, because basically that case is about people being required to get a license to carry concealed guns outside the home. Of course, here in Texas, that's, you know, been the law for a long time. Now, you don't even have to have a license. Does that have an effect here in Texas? If that gets a conservative ruling, I think people would tend to kind of put that out of their minds just because it is such a different climate here.
Yeah, you know, I don't think it has a direct effect. I think the sort of the short version is that's a ruling that's going to have far more implications for what states can restrict in states that actually try to restrict these things. right. But I do think, I mean, you know, it's one thing for folks like Governor Abbott and Attorney General Paxton to get up on the hustings and say, I'm protecting the Second Amendment, and have nothing to cite to. It's something else to say, and the Supreme Court agrees with me. So, you know, I don't think it's going to change the law on the ground here in Texas, frankly, one way or the other. But I do think it has, you know, sort of broader optical implications for what kinds of, for sort of how broad the right is, and therefore how justified elected officials in Texas would be in taking even further steps to, you know, reduce still further what restrictions are left.
Steve, the other big case here that many people in Texas are watching is voting rights. Can you lay out for our listeners what's at stake here? And secondly, what the argument is will be before the justices?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, the court still hasn't put any of the big post-2020 election cases on its docket. But it's possible, for example, that the Georgia case could get there by the end of the term. So I think that's a question about whether some of these, you know, election integrity measures, right, that especially red states have adopted after in response to the election are consistent with the Federal Voting Rights Act. And the federal government has taken the position in the Georgia case that they're not. You know, we saw at the very end of last term, the Supreme Court actually weaken in some important respects Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, the provision that these challenges are based on. You know, I think it's going to be, I don't know that those cases are going to get all the way up this term, Jason, but when they do, you know, that's the next frontier for voting rights, especially as it looks increasingly clear, like we're not going to get voting rights reform out of Congress.
Steve, I'm curious about that as to why that hasn't ended up on the docket. I know that this is a relatively new phenomenon that we're seeing sweeping across the country with these different state legislatures, but it just seems like such an issue of the time right now in front of us. Is this just because things move slowly when it comes to the Supreme Court, or is there another reason that they would maybe avoid that?
No, I mean, things move slowly when it comes to the Supreme Court. And, you know, in contrast to our discussion of the Texas abortion case, where what accelerated the process was the fight over whether to block the law or not, right? There haven't been injunctions to date against these new laws, which would speed up the process. So until and unless that happens, and it might yet, I mean, we might soon get, you know, rulings in some of these cases where some of these laws are blocked by federal district judges. But until that happens, we're going to see the sort of the more, I don't want to say orderly, the more deliberate and oftentimes delayed process of litigation, which, you know, frankly, guys, it can take a case without any hustling, you know, 2.5-3 years, right, to get from filing all the way to the Supreme Court.
It's unbelievable. Give us an idea of the federal government's on the defense for a lot of these big issues. How stressed out is the Justice Department, President Biden's Justice Department right now?
I don't think they're overtaxed from a resources perspective, Jason. I think it's just that there are a lot of fires to put out. And, you know, one of the areas that we haven't talked about as much is, you know, all of these sort of burgeoning challenges to some of the COVID policies, especially the, you know, the vaccination mandate that the Occupational Safety and Health Administration is in the process of unfolding. You know, I think DOJ is always busy. I think that the trickier part is sort of the top level policy decisions about where to prioritize. And, you know, I think it's not for nothing that the federal government has expended a ton of resources on the Texas abortion case. Right. That this is, you know, this is a case that DOJ did not have to bring. This is not an area where it's typically the federal government who's the plaintiff. And yet I think that this was a case where the principle was too important to fight for wholly apart from the politics.
I want to talk about something extraordinary that we've seen over these past several months, too, Steve. And that is we've had Supreme Court justices who have actually publicly talked about how the court is not a partisan animal. And yet a new Gallup poll came out the other day. They've been tracking, you know, the Supreme Court's approval ratings for the job that they're doing for, you know, 20 something years now. That has hit a new low here in America. Now, 40% of Americans think that they're doing a good job there at the Supreme Court. 60% are not weighing in on the good side there. They found that less than a majority of Republicans, Democrats, and Independents are approving of what the court is doing right now, and that trust has fallen in the judicial branch of the federal government in general. How insidious can that be? I mean, that's a big problem if the majority of the country feels that way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is one of the hardest things I find teaching constitutional law in law school, which is, you know, why do we follow the Supreme Court? Why do the three of us sit around spending so much time talking about it, right? And it's not because the Supreme Court has a police force, right? It's not because they go out and, you know, beat down our doors if we don't listen to them, right? We follow the Supreme Court because we believe that their decisions have legitimacy. And, you know, I think the more that public confidence in the justices wanes, the more dangerous that is, because the more we risk a scenario where the court's going to sort of keep pushing away and alienating a large enough chunk of the population so that we stop listening to the Supreme Court. And, you know, there are probably some folks who are like, good, I don't want to listen to the current Supreme Court. And I guess my reaction is a bit more circumspect, which is whatever you think of the current Supreme Court, you know, we might want a Supreme Court 10 years from now. So, you know, I think it's no coincidence that we've seen this, you know, trust us, we're not partisan hacks speaking tour. But guys, look at the speaking tour itself, though. I mean, Justice Barrett gave the we're not partisan hacks speech in an unrecorded speech to which the media were not invited at the Mitch McConnell Center with Mitch McConnell sitting right behind her. You know, I can think of better places to give that speech. Justice Alito, right, I think instead of, you know, I think defending more of the court's work on the so-called shadow docket with all of these emergency applications, spent much of his speech on the topic at Notre Dame Law School attacking its critics, including me. So, you know, I think the court's clearly aware of this. From where I'm sitting, the way to assuage the concerns that are producing this polling is not through a speaking tour, right? It's the decisions are what's going to do the work, right? It's what the court says through the things that matter. And that's why I sort of end where we started, which is like this term is a really big deal because, you know, if we look back in June and see just a complete wipeout along partisan lines, you know, I think that's only going to exacerbate those concerns. Whereas if we see a little bit of moderation, a little bit of compromise, a little bit of sort of, hey, I wasn't expecting that, you know, maybe we see the court at least abate, right, its fall in popularity.
So why do you think that the justices or some of the justices are on this PR tour then?
I mean, guys, they read the same polls we do. And you know, I think the one thing that's quite clear from all of these speeches is that they're reading their critics. And, you know, some of whom they're responding to directly. And, you know, that's healthy. I think that's great. I just think that, I guess that it's not the speaking tour itself that I find awkward, right? It's what they're doing on it. What they're saying and where they're saying it. Like, if you want to convince us that you are, you know, principled jurists, you do that through principled jurisprudence.
You mentioned the shadow docket, and so I guess congratulations are in order here for the new book that's going to be coming out called The Shadow Docket.
I'll get Justice Alito to blurb it.
You should, man, when he's on the speaking tour, making a book tour.
You know what? It might get mentioned somewhere along the way there. Tell us a little bit about why you decided to write this book and why this is such an important issue as far as you're concerned and you know, as far as the court's credibility goes as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about the Supreme Court, but so much of that time we talk about like a handful of high profile merits cases, the gun case, the abortion case, voting rights. And the reality is and has always been that the Supreme Court does so much more than the high profile cases, and that a lot of the stuff the court does is, if not formally, then at least practically invisible, right, to the public at large. Either because it comes down in these inscrutable orders or because it's hyper technical in ways that are, you know, hard for non-lawyers to process. And so, you know, my interest in what folks call the shadow docket is tied to that, right? It's tied to sort of helping everyone to see some of the major, major stuff the Supreme Court does that we tend not to pay attention to, in choosing which cases to hear, which cases not to hear, in granting or denying stays, in, you know, enjoining state policies before a lawsuit even has time to process through the courts. When I started working on the project, guys, I think this was much more in the shadows. The irony of all of this is that I think the proliferation of these kinds of rulings has actually brought a lot more attention to them. You know, the Texas abortion ruling on September 1st, I think, was the first time a lot of folks ever heard the term shadow docket. So, you know, from the perspective of trying to ensure that the public sees the full field of what the Supreme Court's doing and not just the, you know, from 40-yard line to 40-yard line. That's, you know, that's a much broader goal of mine in which the shadow docket's just one pretty important part.
I know you've got the book coming out. You've got the National Security Law podcast as well. Here you are on with us. I don't know where you're finding the time to do all of this. But somewhere in the middle of all of that, you also teach law there at the University of Texas. And I'm curious, you know, I think, you know, we've talked about this a little bit before, how it always seems crazy, history does, when you're living through it. And it seems like it's busier than it's ever been. But these days really do kind of seem that way. And I'm curious, you've taught for several years here, you know, you've put in some time. Has it changed? Have the issues changed? Have the students changed? Are they more engaged with what's going on? It seems like we're more educated. We're hearing about shadow dockets. You know, lay people are learning about these things. Has that changed?
Yes. Unequivocally. I've been teaching for 17 years, and, you know, there was interest in the mid-2000s in these issues, but it was mostly academic interest. You know, for better or for worse, there is a gravity to, you know, what for a long time were viewed as esoteric debates about the role of the Supreme Court, about the relationship between the branches of government, about executive power, about elections and voting rights. There is a gravity to the moment we're in that I think even first-year law students viscerally understand, that has no comparison, guys, since I've been doing this. And, you know, if we look at constitutional history, I think this is probably the first time we've seen this much constitutional tumult, really since the 1930s. The pretty profound shifts in our understanding of the Constitution 1930s. The difference is that came in a period of strong ideological homogeny in the political branches, where you had large Democratic majorities in both chambers of Congress. You had an incredibly popular Democratic president, right? We have the sort of additional complication in this moment of an incredibly divisive and polarized political climate. And I think that's the tricky part here, because, you know, it's not going to take much to push us pretty heavily in one direction or another. Mm-hmm.
I learned something every time I talk to you, Steve. Thanks for taking our call, man.
Thanks, guys. Great to be with you.
So, you know, Jason, you know, at the very beginning of this, you were saying how we always love to hear from Steve Vladeck because he's very good at distilling, breaking down and explaining in lay terms for us lay people, some complex issues that are before the courts. You always feel smarter after you've talked to him.
No
doubt. But sometimes you feel a little more worried, too. You know, in that last little bit there about just how divided this country is right now. When we look back at the arc of history, we're really divided right now. It's not just our imagination because we're living through it. And you just wonder, you know, what's that going to look like as we go through this next Supreme Court term? And, you know, we get rulings on a lot of these issues that are dividing people. Does that get even worse?
Yeah, it almost makes you want to summon another beer out of the fridge. I mean, I hope our boss isn't still listening this far into the podcast, but I might have to have another one after that. You know, I've always wondered, you and I are the same age, what, 3 days apart. But I always wonder, has it been worse in the last century than it is now as far as the division? And I want to say it has been with the racial strife of the 60s. Supreme Court had a number of landmark decisions in the 60s and 70s. Of course, you and I were way too young to recognize those. But I wonder kind of where this falls in the arc of American history.
I don't know. I think
where
about,
we are right now, you know?
Yeah, I think about that. And, you know, there's you think about the fights that went on, you know, before our time in the 50s and 60s and all of that. And a lot of those fights, though, Jason, are happening all over again now. We've got, you know, so much going on with the push for equality and racial justice, all in at the same time that we're dealing with a pandemic, which, you know, we haven't had to deal with at any point in our lifetimes. And then at the same time, we've got all of this political strife that's going on. And, you know, in none of those times prior did we have cable news and social media. And I think that is amplifying so much of this division that we see between people right now. And you just wonder, you know, does this keep spiraling? Does it get even worse? And, you know, I hate to take us down that road as we come to an end here.
Yeah, I'm definitely having another beer for that, man. But no, you're exactly. I totally agree. I have plenty of friends who work in cable news, but cable news and social media, and I would argue AM radio as well, has spun up so many people. Cable news, obviously, on both sides. And I will say, and I don't think many would disagree, I would say cable news has radicalized a number of people on both sides over the last 25 years. This has been in your face for 25 years. And it's not news. That's the thing. It's opinion.
Well,
I think cable opinion shows.
I think even the bigger threat, though, is social media, because I can't tell you how many times I've tried to, you know, you try to talk to people, you know, but they don't listen. But you see them post things, they post links to articles, and I always look at the source of that article, and it's like 123abc.com. So yeah, and it's like, guys, that is not a real news outlet. And a lot of it comes from people who just don't realize. They think that if something is published and they can read it, then it had to have been fact checked and it has to be true. It doesn't. So look for your sources, you know, and chances are, if you're only finding some crazy, salacious, wild headline in one place and no one else is reporting on that, and it's from a source that probably no one else has heard of, chances are it's probably not true.
Yeah, oh, exactly. There's a little short little TikTok that's out there that always cracks me up. It's a woman probably in her mid 30s or so, and she says, you know, I'm at the age now where if you think the sky is green, congratulations, you're right. It totally is. And then she walks out off screen.
She's given up.
She's given up, and so many people have. And yeah. You know, we both have people in our own families.
Oh yeah.
That might hold just outrageous views one side or the other. And, you know,
we're going to get to hear those soon for Thanksgiving. Yay.
I know, right? Maybe it should be a Zoom Thanksgiving. We can put them on mute.
No, forget that. I'm just going to do Thanksgiving over my sink.
You probably will, dude. I can't believe you, man. You're an animal.
Hey, I just saw you stuff your face on here. You're not far from me. Okay.
Yeah,
you're
getting there. I'm not stuffing it so much where I have to put it over the sink so it can catch all the things falling out. You're crazy, dude.
Oh, I've got to change my ways.
Well, thanks so much for listening. I learned a lot about the law and about Wheeler today in this episode.
More than you have probably ever wanted to know.
Yeah, and we should all be thankful that he's not doing this podcast over a sink. We'll see y'all next Tuesday.
See y'all then.